You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm very happy now to welcome Rabbi Nahum Ward Lev. He's scholar in residence at Temple Beth Shalom here in Santa Fe. He is the leader of the Beit Midrash of Santa Fe, and we'll find out what that is in a moment. And he's author of the new book, The Liberating Path of the Hebrew Prophets, Then and Now. There will be a book launch on May 21st at 7 o'clock at Temple Beth Shalom, where he will be speaking and signing books. Welcome.
Delighted to be here, Mary Charlotte. I've loved your program.
Oh, thank you so much. So this book is, in a way, a study of the Torah, which is the first books of the Old Testament. And as the title of the book suggests, it's very much about the theme of liberation. And I thought maybe we could start there, because the word liberation, freedom, has so many meanings. What is that? Like, where do you start with this whole concept of liberation? Liberation from something? From what?
Right. You know, there's an interesting thing on the famous line that Moses speaks to Pharaoh, or Moses says to Pharaoh, you know, let my people go. And that line is, you know, well known. And the second half of that line is, so they might serve me. So it's freedom from, in order to be free to something greater. You know, so the liberation process in the Torah is really all about wherever we are, there's sort of restrictions in terms of how we're able to bring forth our potential, how loving, how connected we can be. And so it's liberation from whatever constrictions there are into a capacity for deeper, more mutual, more loving relationship.
In the example you just gave, I imagine many of our listeners would say, let my people go so that they can serve me means like from one bondage into another.
Yeah. And the rabbis really look a lot at that. In fact, the word for slave is the same root as the word for being servants to God. Yeah. So I have a chapter in the book about God's relationship to creation, and where I use the Genesis story. So it's really clear that God is sovereign, is totally invested in the flourishing of creation, that God's power and God's sovereignty aren't about making things great for God. God doesn't need that, you know, but that, and by God, I don't mean some guy in the sky. We can talk about that in a little bit, but that God's deep desire is the flourishing of all of creation, of humans and animals and plants. And so that they might serve me, that when they're serving Pharaoh, it's like for Pharaoh, and it's really a bondage that limits the flourishing and is harshly oppressive on the people. But to serve God is actually an opportunity to fulfill our potential, to fulfill who we can become.
The word God is so charged, again, for so many of us, because it is that bearded guy in the nightgown in the sky kind of thing.
Yes.
And in the Old Testament is often a vengeful God, is not very nice, but in all ways seems to be personified, and yet the modern understanding has more to do with a sort of like spirit of love kind of thing than a, you know, male presence with two eyes in it.
Yes. You know, in the very beginning of the book, I have a little piece on how I translate God's name, that in the Torah, in the Bible, God has a name, which is four Hebrew letters, Yud and He and Vav and the letter He. And in the Jewish tradition, we don't know how to pronounce God's name. And that's the sense that for me to know your name, like Mary Charlotte, means not, it's not just your label, that I know something about you. I know something about who you are and your essence. You know, and you know something about Nahum. But God is so beyond our understanding, we say, no, we can't pronounce God's name. It's really a mystery. And those four letters are the word to be in the Hebrew in the past, present, and future. So it's a name that has something to do with being beyond time. And when God appears to Moses and says, you know, go confront Pharaoh. And Moses wants to know God's name, which is why, give me some power. I want your name. And God says, I will be with you. You know, that somehow that's what, and Moses, and God says, I will be what I will be. That's my name. So that sense of an alive presence, you know, and beingness itself, I think is implied in that name. And so throughout the book, I translate what is often translated as Lord or my Lord as living presence. You know, for the rabbis, they translated the untranslatable name as my Lord because they were living under Roman domination and Caesar was the Lord. And this was their way of saying, no, you're not the God. You're not the Lord. There's a power far greater than you. And we are not in service to you. We're in service of a far greater power than you, in the real Lord. So for the rabbis, understanding Adonai, Yud Heh Vav Heh, as Lord meant something. As you implied today in our democratic or hopefully democratic societies, Lord no longer really has an implication that is helpful to us. And so, but I think living presence. It's like, if I ask you, do you believe in God? I don't know. Do you have a sense that there's a living presence here, right, among us right now? You know, often people who may not have a faith in God would say, yeah, I get there's a living presence here.
Well, and that living presence, I think, for so many of us is actual biological life.
Yes.
And so what are we talking about? Is it something beyond biological life? I mean, biological life is pretty big. It's
yes.
sort of everything that we know and care about. Then nurtured by the soil, which is also biological life, and the sky, which rains and keeps us alive, and so on.
Yes, yes. When we attach the word biological to life, it's a way of saying life is understood through the perspective of the science of biology. But life is so much grander than any science of biology now or ever can ever fully describe and fully portray, you know. So I don't think it's outside of life, but it's outside of and beyond our biological understanding of life. That life is of myriad dimensions, of which biology captures, you know, a few, some.
I guess I use that word because when I think about life, I think about creatures,
yes.
things that reproduce,
yes.
things that.
Yes.
emerge and evolve and,
yes.
and change. And I'm not sure what isn't captured in that concept that you're talking about.
Yes, yes. You know, the great rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said that the beginning of the religious instinct is wonder and awe. You know, and so it's nothing outside of life. It's just the awareness of the wonder that anything is, that life is, that you and I can communicate, that you know, the beauty of this day, it's within life. You know, the rabbis say that God is both within and beyond life, you know. And for me, that sense of beyond is really a sense of there's something here that's beyond what I can fully grasp. But it's not outside of life. It's just beyond my own ability to grasp it. The whole sense of often people talk about the eternity within a moment. You know, like, there's something about this moment that is wow, but I can't describe it to you. And I think it's that wow that's beyond that we're talking about here.
I wanted to ask you, how did you become a rabbi? Was there some sense of this wonder that we're talking about that drove you on your path?
Well, it's hard to tell a short story. But part of the story is I came from a very assimilated family and really had no interest in Judaism at all. I was really very involved in politics and activism. And in 1968, I had worked for Eugene McCarthy's presidential campaign in New Hampshire and Massachusetts and California, and was leaving the McCarthy headquarters the day of the California primary when someone said Bobby Kennedy had been shot. And as we all know, Dr. Martin Luther King had been shot 2 months earlier. And something in me just broke. It just broke. And I began a need to find a deeper mooring for my life. And I happened to be a camp counselor at an institute that had a college institute connected to it that I was not part of, that brought the greatest minds in the Jewish world to meet with these Jewish college kids. And the camp that the institute director took an interest in me and invited me to be with him and whoever his guest was for that week after I put the kids to bed. So I spent a summer with the greatest minds in the Jewish world at a time that I was looking for something. And that director, Dr. Shlomo Bardeen, there's many people who became rabbis under his influence. I'm only one of many. He kept saying that Judaism was a civilization with ethics and justice at its core. And that's what I was looking for. And so I began a study. And I, many years later, like 5 years later, 6 years later, went to rabbinical school, not to become a rabbi, but I wanted to know more. I wanted to learn more. I'll share one more little story. One of my teachers was Reb Zalman Schechter Shalomi, a great mystic, founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement. I was teaching high school and living in Berkeley, California, and I went to a workshop that Zalman gave, and in Judaism, in a sense, there's four worlds, world of the body, the world of the heart, world of the mind, and the world of the soul. And he took us in experientially through those four worlds, and it was like a whole new vista for me. And I said, wow, he knows the gates to those worlds like I know the street signs of Berkeley. I said, I need to know more about that. So I went to rabbinical school to learn, really. When I met my wife, Shelley, she said, I don't really want to be married to a rabbi. I said, I'm just studying. I'm not going to.
Famous last words.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a short story. Yeah.
And so you were just studying, but then you did take that path to become a rabbi.
Yeah, yeah. I became really interested in Jewish education. Going back to what Dr. Bardeen had said in terms of the ethical, and not for him, but for me, the spiritual essence that was within Judaism. And I really intended to be, I was very involved in camps, in a camp director. But in rabbinical school, the only way you can make money is by being a student rabbi. And so they sent me out over the years to be a student rabbi in all these little congregations. And I saw that good things happened, and I could be effective. But even when I was ordained, I told Shelley, when I interviewed with all of the people that were interested in hiring, I said, I'm just going to tell them the truth about who I am. I don't know if I should be a pulpit rabbi. And if they want me, then maybe I'll do it. it was all like that. Mystery tour.
one step leads to the next.
One step leads to the next. Exactly.
So you were very drawn to these teachings and you've really found your way in scripture. And that's what your book is about in a lot of ways. But of course, you also brought yourself to the scripture, which was, you know, coming up in the 1960s and being a political activist. And the word liberation is a word from that era as well.
Yes.
And so I wondered sort of how you consciously combine a sense of the kind of political and social needs in the present. And you talk a lot about injustice and social injustice and so on. And scripture. Is it a push to bring those things together? Was it all there, you know, several thousand years ago?
It was all there several thousand years ago. You know, I mean, I think a true, careful reading of the Torah and of the Bible is that social justice, the flourishing of all, concern for the marginalized. You know, the most common commandment in the Torah, like 34 times, is do not oppress the widow, the orphan, or the immigrant. And those were emblematic of marginalized and vulnerable people in society. I mean, the prime concern of the Torah is the flourishing of the marginal, because if the marginal can flourish, then we're all going to be well. I mean, that's how you see if a society is really going to be healthy or not. So that's a prime concern. You know, I came to the prophets. I lead, as you said, a Beit Midrash. Beit Midrash means house of exploration. It's the traditional rabbinic term for a learning community. And as I say, I lead it. I don't teach it. The text is the teacher, and my job is to facilitate a good conversation around the text and to teach good skills for learning deeply into the text.
Sounds like St. John's.
Exactly. It sounds like it's a Jewish Johnny. Yeah, exactly. And also what I love about Beit Midrash is it's not academic. It's about how do we live this into our lives. We don't leave it on the page. We're obligated to live this into our lives. And so I've led a Beit Midrash, two groups, at the Temple Beth Shalom for almost 20 years now. And one of the groups, the evening group, about 10 years ago, I said, I think we're living in prophetic times. The prophets who lived, who were like before the common era, BCE, maybe from 750 to 550 before the common era, so over 2,500 years ago, they were living in a time when the backbone of Israelite society, the small farmer, was generation after generation dispossessed from the land through harsh debtor laws and high taxation, and wealth was being accumulated in the hands of wealthy merchants and large landowners. And these prophets were people who said this is intolerable, and who said that the institutions of the day, the king and the temple, were participating in the oppression rather than participating in supporting the flourishing of the people, and that ultimately they were coming down because they were no longer serving the needs of the people. So in my imagination, it's like, imagine, you know, big, massive structure, temple, and big, massive structure, king, and a lot of rigmarole and ritual and all of that. And the prophets say, nah, it looks solid, it looks monumental, it's actually quite vulnerable, it's unsustainable, it's coming down. And then they had the ability to transcend the brokenness of that moment and to envision an alternative future where all could flourish. And so I said to my students, that's what we need. We need the courage to say, this is coming down, this sort of global capitalist order that in its current iteration is leading to the accumulation of great wealth in very few hands and many, many, many people, you know, suffering, is not sustainable. And we need to be able to name that and proclaim that and say why it's coming down. And also we need to offer and to envision an alternative future. What is the other way forward? You know, that every empire presents itself as après moi le déluge. After, there's no alternative to me. The alternative to the present order is chaos. There's no other way. So we have to live with it. And the prophets were saying, no, there is an alternative. So this is deep in the Bible. And for me, it was wanting to bring that forward and then see how those themes are developed by modern prophets like Martin Luther King and Abraham Joshua Heschel and bell hooks and Grace Lee Boggs and Paulo Freire and Eric Fromm.
Now, when you say these people are modern prophets, first of all, what do we mean by prophecy?
Thank you. That's a great question. Yeah. People often think about prophets as angry old men shaking their fingers at harsh judgment of people. And that's, I think, an imperial misread of a radical text. These prophets were human beings that were so imbued with God's deep love for all of creation that they found oppressive systems intolerable and had the courage to name them. And they had the courage also and the vision out of that love to articulate an alternative future. So the prophets are not foreseeing a future. What they are saying is this current configuration, the status quo, is not sustainable. It is coming down. We don't know exactly how or when it is coming down. And they're not predicting a future in terms of the alternative, but they're foreseeing a possible future. I mean, their gift is to articulate a way forward. And I think, you know, we so much need that in this day. In this day, we need not only policy change, but we need culture change. We need, you know, a culture that's far less about production and consumption and far more about love and creativity. And we need the vision to begin to see, well, what might that look like and how might that be possible? And that's what the prophets did in their day. And that's what we need so much in ours.
It does raise the question of, did they do it then? I mean, why are we still facing these same problems, generation,
yes,
you know, century and millennium, one after another?
Yes, yes. Actually, in the prophet's own day, they were not heeded. You know, that ultimately those kingdoms that they said were coming down did not alter their course, and they were brought down, and they were destroyed, just as the prophets had seen, not known, but thought that they would be destroyed.
Give us an example of one of those. Like, who was the prophet? What was the government? How did it come down?
Okay. Well, there were many prophets, but I'll share
two.
So the prophet, because prophet Jeremiah is living in and around Jerusalem in about, let's say, 600 before the Common Era, and he lives up into the time that the Babylonians destroyed the kingdom in 586 before the Common Era and took the people into exile. And he basically gave the prophetic message that this is unjust, that we need to take care of the poor and we're not. We need to take care of the immigrant and we're not. We need to take care of the widow and the needy and we're not. And this is intolerable. And it's, and as he had foreseen, it was coming down, and it did come down. The Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and took the people off into exile. Another prophet I want to mention is the prophet Deutero-Isaiah. I say Deutero because there are at least two prophets within the book of Isaiah in the Bible.
Okay.
Deutero, the second Isaiah, is living in that exile. And he's the one to say, it looks really dark now, but actually God is living presence is going to take us back and we're going to rebuild our community. And he foresaw that as an alternate future. I mean, all of the prophets did, but Isaiah was among those that saw it in the most detail and most elaborately foresaw that future. So the prophets were not listened to in their day. And what happens is that after the kingdoms were destroyed and then the people did go back, as Isaiah had foreseen, they needed a way forward, a new way of understanding. Well, I mean, how is it? I mean, imagine for people who thought that their temple was God's house, the barbarian that destroyed God's house, how would they reconstitute their community under faith in God? So people brought together these prophetic texts generations later to help the people understand what had happened and to envision a new way forward with God. So these prophets did not change history immediately in their day, but they injected into what became the Bible and later had an influence on Western civilization, basic values that are critical for our day, for the revolution of values that Martin Luther King talked about. I mean, the prophets and those who gathered were the ones that said, not only do we need to take care of the widow and the orphan and the stranger, but they were the ones that said, an inclusive dialogue of all people is the way forward. And they were the ones who really valued bringing different points of view together in a creative and fruitful way, which is such an important part. I mean, if we read people like Paulo Freire and Grace Lee Boggs and Martin Luther King, they're all that we need to bring people together in conversation to envision a way forward. We don't want to wait for it to come from the top or from some think tank. I mean, we need that, you know, but we need all of the people involved in what we need to move forward in a flourishing way. And so
a fundamental concept of democracy.
Right, a fundamental concept of democracy. The prophets were, it's not about the priest and it's not about the temple. It's about this community's relationship to living presence and the justice within this community. That's what it's all about.
One of the things that I think happens when you have, because you're, without using these words, you're kind of referring to what today looks like left-right dialogue and the, you know, the quote-unquote right-wing, I don't even believe in those terms as much as I used to, but we'll talk about production and consumption and how important those things are, and the left will, as you say, talk about creativity and love. Well, creativity and love doesn't put food on the table. I mean, we consume, we produce, we make food, we make other things. Those things aren't bad. It's the way you do them and whether you exploit people and the earth in the process of doing them, not the fact that there's production and consumption. That is as basic to life as breathing.
Yeah, it's about means and ends. Is consumption and production the goal, or is it the means? You know, is flourishing of life, is rich and robust community, is loving relationship, is creating art and celebrating, is that what life is about, and production and consumption are means to it? Or is the goal to produce as much as I can and to consume as much as I can, and that's a good life. So I think it's about means and ends.
And along the way, the whole question of inequality and injustice, you know, the thing about production and consumption, who has more, who has less, who gets to profit from that, who doesn't.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. In the sense that when too much wealth and power is concentrated in too few hands, then inevitably it leads to injustice. That's why, you know, the prime concern of the Bible, of the Torah, is economics. I mean, there's more regulations about economics than about anything else. You know, about you need to leave the seventh year of your land fallow. You can't pick up the grain that falls. You need to leave your corners for the poor. I mean, all of these things, you know, a fundamental concern. You know, in the 49th year, after 49 years, then Jubilee year, the land went back to its original owner. You know, redistribution of property was, you know, a fundamental concern.
Right. And those are also agricultural values. Leaving land fallow means you're going to be able to create more food later.
Exactly. The land is living entity too, and needs to be respected, and the rhythms of the land need to be honored and respected. Yeah.
One of the things that you said in the book that I thought was sort of shocking was that you thought that the creation story in the book of Genesis was compatible with modern science. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and actually the great rabbi, the first rabbi of the State of Israel, Rav Kook, in 1935 or so, also wrote that the Bible and evolution are not in conflict with each other. If we look at the first creation story, the 7 days of creation, it's a story about evolution.
How's that?
So in the first 3 days, God creates the first day light, the second day the heavens and the earth, and the third day the dry land and the seas. So on the fourth day, the potential of light becomes fulfilled in the sun, moon, and the stars. On the fifth day, the potential of the sky and the waters become fulfilled in the creation of fish and birds. And the sixth day, the potential of the third day of dry land becomes fulfilled in the creation of land animals and among them human beings. So, and all of it, through all of it, it's a call and response that God is calling out. I mean, why does God say anything? Why doesn't God just do the thing? I mean, you know, like Nike, just do it. You know, God doesn't just do it. God calls out. Why does God call out? Because it's relational. It's a conversation. God is in conversation with creation. So he's calling out the potential. So on the fifth day, God says, let the waters swarm forth with fish. And then the waters respond by swarming forth. So he's energizing the waters to give forth the potential of water to become fish, which is an amazing evolutionary process. On the sixth day, it's outrageous. God says, let the land exodus and, animals. The Exodus is the word. I mean, it's not translated that way. It's the exact same word as the people leaving Egypt, which is that the land is giving forth. I mean, these people knew that that's not how animals are born, but they said that as a way of saying God is releasing the potential of the land, of the soil, to become living flesh. So it's an evolutionary process.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's really struck me for a long time that some people are just naturally, as you seem to have been, or through the circumstances of your life, drawn to a kind of scripture path, and other people are drawn to the path of science.
Yeah.
And you can't make anybody be any different than how they're going to be. And so, you know, you find your way in each one and hopefully don't fight too much about it.
Yeah, I think these days that conflict between religion and science is moving towards resolution. You know, like in quantum mechanics, we have the understanding that everything is relationship, you know, that nothing is what it is outside of a relationship, which is the key biblical understanding, you know, that it's all relationship. I mean, you know, that there's not, well, there's first is Mary Charlotte and there's Nahum and we're individual and then we come into relationship, but actually we are a relationship. Relationship, we're here for the sake of relationship, you know. And so that sense of relationship in quantum mechanics, also that sense of probability, uncertainty. And there is, you know, throughout the Torah and the Bible, this sense of, you know, God's name is I will be what I will be, the sense of becoming. You know, in the creation story, God doesn't make little fish. God empowers the potential to come forth with what it's going to come forth with. So that sense of of uncertainty. Science is now moving in that direction. So I don't see these as two competing in disciplines. And I think at the center of both science and religion is the sense of wonder, and really wanting to inhabit that wonder more deeply, that when we open up our eyes, to this moment, to us being together, to this world, it's a wonder. And science is trying to deepen our relationship to that wonder, and religion is trying to deepen our relationship to that wonder, using different disciplines, but both using close observation.
One of the things that I think happens, and it happens with pretty much every religion, I mean, you've seen Christianity, which is a religion of love, turn into unspeakable cruelty.
Yes.
Even Buddhism,
yes,
in Myanmar,
yes,
has become perverted.
Yes.
And Judaism, when you look at Israel, I mean,
yeah,
if people are listening to this on Monday, on Tuesday night, there's a screening at the CCA of a film called Creation and Catastrophe, which is about the what they call the Nakba, the disaster, the catastrophe in Palestinian lands. And, the words disaster and catastrophe come up in your book too. These are common experiences to everybody in religion.
Yes.
And not only religion, but that sense of dominating territory, whether that territory be land or something else,
yes,
becomes what we do. And just unspeakable cruelty comes about, and in Israel it's so painful to witness, because this is a religion that, as you are talking about, and that has been demonstrated in so many countless ways, is a religion that promotes ethics.
Yes.
But the opposite is going on.
Yes, and it is so painful, just as you say. I find it really helpful the essay that the great American philosopher William James wrote at the turn of the 1900s in his collection, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And what he says is that every religion goes through a life cycle. It starts off with some deeply enlightened person, be it Buddha or Jesus or Moses or Muhammad. And that person has an insight in a relationship to reality that is just awesome and attracts people to that person. And then followers come, and there's a small circle of people, and they're living this very alive tradition that is often full of love and full of wisdom. And then the founder dies, and over the years, the challenge of the followers is, well, how do we keep this thing going? And there's an inclination within human nature to kind of try and pin it down. And so rules and doctrines and regulations and who's in and who's out and who's with us and who's not with us come in the natural evolution of things. We see that not only in religion, we see that in a human life, and we see that in any human institution. That's why they need to be living institutions. And what happens in religions is that then you get someone coming along and say, well, no, we've lost it, folks. We need to get back to the original. And we can talk about that. I mean, I know it best in Christianity and in Judaism. There have been several times within the evolution of these religions where people have come along and said, no, we're really lost. We need to get back to, within Judaism, like in the 1700s with the Baal Shem Tov, Israel Ben Eliezer, who was a deep reformer. And at the time, there was a sense of,
and a mystic.
And at the time, there was a sense of elites who were highly educated and poor people who were not valued as much. And then the Baal Shem Tov just broke through all of that. And to me, that is the role of the prophet, to say what looks like how it is actually a perversion of how it was supposed to be and should be. We need to name that and break out of it and fulfill our potential into doing something radical and new, old and new, in moving forward. And so, that happens in every human institution. The way
it happens in companies.
It happened, yes. The way that I like to think about it is, in some kind of way, you need the people. In the Bible would be the king. You need people who were all about stabilizing things and making it run and holding on to the status quo, and they get really into it. But if they're in charge too long, it just gets more and more oppressive. And you need the prophet, the person that comes in, no, wait a second, you're not listening to the people on the margins. You need to hear the people who are oppressed and the people who are suffering. We need their voices included as well. So with a religion and companies and countries and societies, we need that conversation between the king and the prophet, or between those who were into the status quo and those who are into, we need to revolutionize this.
So if that's a natural cycle that happens generation after generation, millennium after millennium, is there any hope for a stable social order? Or just does it just devolve? I mean, I think of the sort of Confucian sense yes. of cycles in government, you yes. know, in and leaders, and then the fall, and then yes. chaos, and so yes. on.
You know, I'd like to answer that in a personal way. One of my great teachers, a longtime spiritual director, was Father Francis Dorf. And I met Fran when I was going through a very difficult transition. The congregation that I was in Silicon Valley was not a good fit for me, and I needed to leave. And it was hard because everything was going great and all that, but I was dying inside. And Fran taught that in a creative life, there's a cycle. And it's true in a life of myself and of institutions and countries. So you get a status quo, and then you get a point that's no longer working, and you got to let go. So the first thing is letting go. And Fran talked about letting go in trust. The second step in the cycle was letting be in hope. And that, for me, that was really wise. It's like after letting go, okay, I've let go. Now I'm going to build something. No. It's like create some space here for what wants to emerge. You know, you need to create some space for this. Letting be in hope. The third is letting grow in love. And then the fourth is letting flow in grace. And what Fran taught is that each time we go through the cycle, we may be able to do it more skillfully. So, you know, God's name is I will be what I will be. We are in the middle of a becoming. You know, part of what I wrote about in the book is we're all on a liberation journey, not only people, but all of creation. Creation is a liberation journey. Creation is a becoming. All the plants and animals, nothing static around here. Everything is becoming what is becoming. And so we are going to go through, wow, it's great, and oh my God, it's awful, and letting go, and then letting be, and letting grow, and letting flow. Can we do it more skillfully? That's really the question. That's what, you know, where the learning is, I think, for us. Yeah.
You write also in the book about the practices that people can do, yes. presumably to more skillfully allow the kind of cycles that you just mentioned. What are some of those practices?
Yeah, well, one of them is gratitude practice. Just taking a moment and noticing the gift that this moment is. In the tradition, the Jewish tradition, we're to say a blessing of gratitude 100 times a day. Like, really taking time, you know, like.
Do you do that?
I work on it. You know, like right now, Marisha, I'm so grateful that we can be together, and for your skill and commitment that we can do this. I'm really grateful to you, and all that you've done over the years. I'm really grateful, you know. And so in saying that, it's like I've been grateful this whole time, but I haven't dwelled in that gratitude in the same way. So gratitude practice is really important practice.
I heard the other day somebody said, you get the most out of gratitude practice when you find gratitude toward people who have hurt you. Have you ever heard that?
I haven't. No.
I thought, what would it be like to practice that? I tried to do it and then I fell asleep. But
you know, in the Buddhist metta practice, you know, you start with the people who are easiest to love, and then you work with yourself, and then you try, and then you think about people who, you know, so yeah, who have hurt you. So that's true in metta. We don't do it cold. We need some lift off first.
Yeah, right. You know, you warm up into it.
You warm up into it. But yeah, I think that's a great idea. Yeah. So I'll mention two more, but there's many. I'll mention three. Wonder practice. This, for me, this is a big spiritual practice. It's like taking a moment to really dwell in wonder and to feel what that feels like in me. You know, like, ooh, attending, you know, wonder practice. You know, as I said, Abraham Joshua Heschel said, the beginning of relationship to the living presence is, wow, wonder, you know. Sabbath.
Which you can do almost anywhere at any time, really. I mean, I remember once a practice of, I had a flower in a vase and I just started looking at it and it was so intense that I actually had to take a deep breath and stop.
Yeah, you can do anywhere at any time. You know, it's like you're standing in line at Trader Joe's kind of thing, you know? Wow, there's a lot to wonder on going around.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot to wonder. I have many in the book. I'll mention just two more. One is Sabbath. I think, you know, again, our culture is so much about production and consumption as the end, not the means. That to take a day and say, I'm not putting coins in my pocket. I'm not going to use the credit card. I'm not going to go online. I'm going to create a spacious day for myself. Walter Brueggemann has this great book I recommend to everybody hearing this broadcast, Sabbath as Resistance. It's a little book, but Walter's understanding is, this is my term, that Sabbath today is the equivalent of Gandhi's spinning wheel. It's like that's how we create the space to undo the empire, by saying, I'm not participating, at least for a day. You know, and I think Sabbath practice is powerfully important.
And then you can do your other practices during the Sabbath.
Exactly, do your other practices on the Sabbath. Yeah, I think, study in community. You know, my Beit Midrash, I've learned so much more in my Beit Midrash business and community than I ever could have learned with myself or with a couple other rabbis even, you know. And then I think paying attention to what fascinates one and what disturbs one over time. You know, like, what are through lines of fascination and what are through lines of what's disturbing me? Because I think that points the way to where do I need to get involved to be a little bit prophetic today? Where is it that I need to say, this is unjust, this is oppressive, this is coming down, and where do I need to invest myself in to be participating in to articulate an alternative future? You know, there's so many things going on. You know, how do we decide where to focus? I think, you know, where are we fascinated? And were we deeply disturbed? I think that's an important spiritual practice.
The Beit Midrash that you're talking about is kind of a study group that people can come to. Is it sort of interdenominational? Is it open to people who are not Jewish, let's say?
Yes. Yeah. In my study group, we have Jews, we have Christians, we have a Buddhist, we have someone of decidedly no faith at all, you know? Yeah, and it's so rich. But it's, you know, it's like, it's not interfaith. Like you could sit there for a morning and say, oh, which one's the Jew? Which one's the Christian? You know, we would know the one of no faith because she expresses it clearly, but, you know.
But he comes.
Yeah, she. Yeah, for years. Yeah.
Very interesting. So if people want to get involved in that, is it open to members of the community or?
Yeah, for me, this is difficult in that it is open to the members of the community, but there's only a certain number of people who, you know, it's a commitment from September through June and it's often full. So people are welcome to contact me. You can go to my website, rabbinahum.com, RABBINAHUM.com. And my contact information is there and you can email me and I'd be happy to talk to you about the Beit Midrash. But often it's full because people make a commitment for a year and people stay in year after year.
Interesting.
But I am teaching around the community. I'll be at First Press in June. I'm up at Ghost Ranch for a couple of weeks. I'm going to be at Hamakom here in Santa Fe. So I am out in the community if people are interested in this prophetic work. And if people would like to invite me to their community, I'd be happy to share some of this prophetic work there.
And meanwhile, people can come to the book launch of the book, The Liberating Path of the Hebrew Prophets, Then and Now, by Rabbi Nachum Wardlev. And it's at Temple Beth Shalom on the 21st of May, which is a Tuesday at 7 in the evening.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much for sharing this new book with us and the listeners.
Oh, Mary Charlotte, it's been a delight. Thank you very much.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.